Welcome to another episode of the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso, a wine educator and podcast host, and with me is wine writer and author Peter Liam.
Hello, Valerie.
Hi. Peter is one of the esteemed guest instructors of the Wine Scholar Guild's Champagne Master Level program. He was the senior correspondent for Wine and Spirits, the champagne consultant for the vaunted World Atlas of Wine 7th edition by Hugh Johnson and Jancis Robinson. He is a publisher of the award-winning champagneguide.net, and his latest book is the James Beard award-winning Champagne, the Essential Guide to the Wine Producers and Terroirs of the Iconic Region. He splits his time between New York and Champagne. Peter, this is such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As busy as you are, you're giving us a sliver of your time this morning, so that's... And you're in New York right now, correct?
I am in New York.
Okay.
Yes.
When are you going back to Champaign?
Well, we're hosting La Fête du Champagne here in New York, which is our fifth year of doing it. And that's going to be on the weekend of November 10th. So I'm staying in New York until then.
Awesome. Well, let's just dig into this discussion. So we were really thinking about going in the direction of terroir because it's such an interesting aspect of Champagne. When I say dig into this, we're going to go deep into the terroir discussion, and we're going to go beyond the macro view of the chalk soil and the cold climate that many of us associate with Champagne, because there's more to the story. Isn't there, Peter?
Absolutely. Well, I think just, you know, if you take it back a step just to talking about wine in general, for me, really, the most interesting thing about wine is the fact that it demonstrates something about the character from where it comes from. And for me, this is like a foundation of just enjoying wine in general. You know, it's not just that wine tastes good. You know, we don't pay thousands of dollars for a bottle of Burgundy just because it tastes good. You know, we pay for it because it comes from a very specific place and expresses the character of that place. So Champagne, of course, is a unique terroir in the wine world, right? And we've long known this. You know, Champagne is famous for its chalky soils, for its supremely crappy weather. And, you know, and so historically, the Champenois have always been very comfortable with speaking about terroir from a very macroscopic viewpoint. So saying, yes, we have chalky soils, we have cool weather, you know, and all this. And that's certainly very important, but that's only touching the surface of this picture.
Before we move on, and we were discussing this topic earlier, you mentioned a progressive or contemporary movement afoot in Champagne. And many would say, oh, that has to do with the rise of the grower champagne or the farmer fizz or single bottle vineyard or single vineyard bottlings or something specific. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, there's more to this as well, as we just talked about with the terroir.
Yeah, I think that... I mean, certainly, you know, if you can say the, you know, the rise of this grower movement has been this worldwide phenomenon over the past 20 years. And, you know, that's not something to discount. For me, I actually see it in reverse. I see things like appreciation of grower champagne, the rise of single vineyard wines, you know, the increase in organic and, you know, organic biodynamic bottlings, all of this. Mm-hmm. I see these things as symptoms rather than as, you know, really like of causes of their own. You know, I think that over the last, let's say, 20, 25 years, Champagne has been reinventing itself, or it's been asking questions of itself that, you know, maybe haven't been asked in such detail before. And so, I mean, and this works both ways, right? It comes from the producers and it comes from the market, right? Mm-hmm. So on both sides, you have producers and consumers. Really, I mean, it sounds simple maybe, but for me, we're finally starting to look at Champagne as a real wine. And that's hugely important. I mean, I remember, you know, even 20 years ago, starting out as a wine retailer, you know, the discussion about Champagne was always sort of marginalized in the wine world. And honestly, today it still is. You know, I mean, I think, you know, today there are, you know, many people who don't even realize that Champagne is wine, or that, you know, Champagne is even made from grapes. And it's ironic, but, you know, Champagne being one of the world's most famous wines is barely acknowledged as a wine at all. But as I said, all of this is changing, in fact. So if we are to talk about Champagne as a real wine, Champagne as a wine like any other, then that means we have to ask the same questions of Champagne that we do of other wines, right?
Right.
And so, you know, if you look at the wine world in general, you know, you have these themes of viticulture, you know, of conscientious viticulture. You have these themes of terroir expression, of artisanality, whatever that means, of sort of a preference for small scale, hands on, you know, conscientious winemaking versus industrial commercial winemaking. And so, you know, all of this, I mean, whatever applies to your favorite Burgundies and, you know, Barolos and Riojas and whatever, then necessarily has to apply to Champagne too, because it's a wine like any other.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that we don't pay a lot of money for a Burgundy just because it tastes good. It's an experience. Sure. Is that what you're kind of getting at? Between the market and the producers, they're trying to translate the wine into an experience, because that's probably what people maybe are looking for now?
Well, I mean, in essence, you know, drinking a wine is an experience of a place, right? And not that it has, I mean, the place is not necessarily small, right? I'm not saying that all wines, all great wines of the world have to be single vineyard wines, because that's definitely not true. And it's not true when it comes to Champagne. But without exception, any great wine in the world expresses something about the place where it's grown. So with Champagne, I mean, with Champagne, this exists on many different levels. It's sort of like concentric circles, you know, like an onion. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say that like great region-wide blends, right? Like Krug Grand Cuvée or, you know, Louis Roederer Cristal. You know, these things express the idea of the Champagne terroir as a whole, right? They express the idea of the region of Champagne. You know, when you look at the region, at the appellation of Champagne, you know, you can break it down into smaller subregions, and, you know, you can get as granular as you want. The CIVC, which is the sort of governing body of Champagne, they have this wonderful map that breaks the region down into actually 20 different subregions, you know, which is fantastic to look at and to think about. You know, it's maybe a little bit too granular for the average consumer. In my book, I chose to break down the region into 7 different subregions. And, you know, one could argue that this isn't enough. And, you know, that's perfectly fine. But I think the point is to look at Champagne not as a single entity, but as, you know, a group of many different subregions. And so now we have wines that express each of these subregions, right? I mean, we can see like Gaston Chiquet Special Club, you know, coming from this area called the Grand Valais. You know, it's a wonderful expression of of this. You know, we have, you know, many, many Blanc de Blanc champagnes, you know, that express the idea of the Côte de Blanc, you know, this great area of Chardonnay below Epernay. You know, we have wines that can express differences in, like, within the Montagne de France, like the differences between north-facing Pinot and south-facing Pinot, you know, and this is wonderful to see, because historically, we haven't always had access to champagnes that illustrate these sort of smaller ideas of terroir with such detail.
Right, and this brings us to blending, because this is all part of it. So we're not talking a single vineyard. And like you say, and again in your book, that single vineyard doesn't necessarily mean it's the best, because blending is a longstanding tradition in Champagne. It's not going anywhere. There's a reason for it. But it is key to the concept of terroir and the various ways the producers are expressing it. And one of the examples I remember in the book, you talked about Krug and Roederer using a music analogy, like a symphony. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And then we can talk about the Salas reference.
Yeah, this is so there's this analogy that Krug used to use like 15, 20 years ago. They don't use it anymore, and I'm not really sure why, because I think it's very apt. You know, Remy Krug used to talk about the house's different cuvées, you know, and relate them to music. So for him, you know, the Grand Cuvée was like an orchestra. You know, so you have many different instruments all playing together, and, you know, creating this large multi-voiced expression, you know? And the Krug vintage wine, you know, naturally came from a smaller selection of base wines. So this was more like chamber music, or this was like a quartet. So it wasn't an inferior expression. It was a different type of expression, because you had fewer voices participating, right? And then you had Claude Menil, which was like this grand soloist, you know, and with this completely like unfettered, like, you know, like really singular expression of a place. And, you know, and I think, you know, this analogy is terrific, and it can be applied to Champagne as a whole.
I think that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, today there are so many more single vineyard champagnes than there used to be, and I think that's fantastic for, and especially for us as students of Champagne, it's really instructive to see these expressions of you know, individual places. But that doesn't mean to me that all Champagne should become single vineyard wine. I think, well, for one thing, not all vineyards really have all that much to say. And you know, I would argue that most vineyards in Champagne, and honestly, most vineyards anywhere in the world, probably benefit from blending to a certain degree. in terms of completeness and complexity. And so in Champagne, while people are vinifying more and more of these vineyards individually, blending is still the norm, right? And sometimes that's difficult for people to reconcile because people think, well, because we're so trained to think of terroir in a very strictly Burgundian sense, right? Mm-hmm. And so the goal of a Burgundian winemaker is to express each individual vineyard. And so people think, well, if you're blending all these things together, then doesn't that negate the idea of terroir? Doesn't that negate the expression of terroir? And actually, I don't think so. I think that that if you look at it another way, you know, if you think about the way that, like, say, a chef assembles ingredients of a dish, right? It's not, you know, with very few exceptions, you go to a restaurant and a dish isn't just one thing, right? A dish is composed of many different ingredients and many different components. And just the fact that these are assembled together doesn't negate the importance of each of these individual components, right? And each of these, and it also doesn't negate the importance of quality in each of these. And so in Champagne, I think what's happening today is that the best producers are, even if they're blending, from many different base wines, they are paying much more, they're paying closer attention to the individual base wines, you know, and oftentimes, almost always, you know, the best producers are vinifying individual parcels separately to preserve their identities, you know, all the way up until blending, to have this vast palette from which to blend, and trying to increase, both the quality and the expression of each of these base wines, to enhance the final blend.
I want to take a little side trip real quick, since you're mentioning all these things that the winemaker does, because one of the most incredible things I took away from the Master Level Champagne class was when we talked about the different styles, and of course we know winemaking is part of terroir. You know, man's mm-hmm. intervention is definitely sure. a part of that. So when we talked about the different houses, we had these little spider graphs of the different styles and who used big oak and who, like Bollinger, and who used little oak and who used more oxidized wines and then who used more reduction styles. And then all these different things that come into play to the point where, wow, all champagne does not taste the same. It is not made the same. It's not, it's from not only all over these seven terroirs or these 20 regions, but also the way they make the wine, time on the lees, more reserve wines or less reserve wines. So that all comes into play too, to create this totally, I don't know if you want to call it an orchestra. What would you call that?
No, definitely. Yeah. I understand what you're saying. And yes, and this, I think, plays a role in any wine region too, right? In any wine region, you see that different winemakers have different styles. And, in Burgundy, you can take a given vineyard and find, five different examples of this vineyard, and you have five radically different wines. Maybe they're all tied together by this common thread of, terroir expression, but you can have, very radically different wines. In Champagne, I think that maybe we feel this a little bit more because, for the last almost half century, Champagne has been very dominated by stainless steel winemaking, mm-hmm. And so it makes someone who uses a little bit of wood really stick out. And, today, you could argue not so much because there are so many people using wood in Champagne. But then also today, there are people using wood in so many different ways. So there, even just within that, there's a huge diversity. But yeah, certainly that adds layers and levels of complexity to the discussion.
Right. That's like an all-day concert is what that is, with a bunch of different bands taking the stage, it sounds like.
Yeah, perhaps.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm going to get us back on the road here because we did take that little side trip. That was one of the things that I took away that amazed me that I never even mm-hmm. considered before. And I'm sure many listeners can relate to that experience. But to get back on the road, I cannot imagine studying wine without maps. I know many listeners will agree. It would be like champagne without bubbles, in my opinion. So these maps, sure. these Larmat's maps, what an incredible story. What you went through to find them. And why you felt they were such an essential part of your book project. Could you give us some more insight on that?
Yeah, so I first became aware of the existence of these maps fairly early on in my wine career, but they were very rare, very difficult to find. The story of these maps, so there was a publisher in Paris by the name of Louis Larmat, and he was commissioned by the INAO to create vineyard maps of all of France's major wine regions, right? And so this was a fantastic project. Unfortunately, it came at a really bad time. This was in the 1940s. But he completed this project, and so he created these fantastic portfolios of maps from all these, you know, major wine regions. So there are maps of Burgundy, there are maps of Bordeaux, the Loire. You know, he even did some maps of Cognac. So the Champagne ones were published in 1944, and these were printed in a particularly limited run. The first printing of these, actually, there were only 150 copies. And so there are seven maps in total, and they're large. You know, they sort of fold out, and they're collected in an unbound portfolio with some accompanying text and photos, but it's not much. You know, the real draw is these maps. Mm-hmm. There were 150 to begin with. These were reprinted again in the 1950s. In those reprints, you can find branded ones. So you'll see, like, you know, maps that have a Moët & Chandon stamp on them and that show, you know, like different vineyards belonging to the house and things like that. Right. But the original ones remain very rare and extremely difficult to find. So I spent years, you know, trying to track down a complete set, and I finally succeeded in acquiring, you know, a complete set of one of the original 150. And so that's what I reprinted in my book, all seven of these original maps from 1944. I guess the reason that they're still so fascinating, you know, even though they're so old, is that as consumers, we have never seen vineyard maps of Champagne in this kind of detail. Vineyard maps of Champagne exist. They're like the local, you know, cadastre, which is like the local surveying for land ownership and things like that. You know, these things are required to be published and so forth. But those are really available, you know, like, I mean, those are available to winemakers and, you know, those are available very, very locally. We as wine students have never seen vineyard maps of Champagne, you know, approaching this kind of detail. And so even though the appellation is a little bit different now, the appellation is bigger, you know, there are more vineyards, these maps are still extremely valuable because they allow us to see Champagne in this, like, super granular light that hasn't been typical for some time. You know, when I first acquired these, they were extremely helpful for me, you know, as I was learning about Champagne. So upon publishing this book, you know, I really wanted to make these more available to others, just because the originals are so difficult to find and so expensive. And so that, you know, that was really one of my goals in publishing this book.
I'm wondering if your backyard is on here, the one in Avis.
Well, yeah. So first moved to Champaign in 2006, and I lived in the village of Dizy for 6 years. Dizy is just outside of Epernay. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my backyard in Dizy is on those maps.
That's a Gaston-Chiquet, right? Was it? Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, yeah.
It's just behind Gaston-Chiquet, yeah.
All right. So listeners, you go grab these maps. You can go see where Peter lives when he's in Champaign. That's awesome. I'm just kidding. Do not stalk the man. But thank you for sharing that. These are so special.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Now I live in Epernay. And okay. So, you know, I've moved to the big city of Epernay.
All right.
I'm not sure that my backyard appears on the maps anymore.
They are stunning, though. So thank you for sharing those with us in this book. But I want to ask one more question. Well, actually, two more questions. Should we discuss climate change and how that's figuring into the progressive or contemporary movements in Champagne?
Well, climate change, like everywhere else in the wine world, climate change is a huge topic and you know, one that everyone is, I guess, worried about. I think that with climate change, you feel it more at the marginal areas, right? Or you feel it more at the extremes. So you feel the effects of it more drastically in the coolest wine regions and in the warmest wine regions. Mm-hmm. And Champagne is, you know, certainly one of the coolest wine regions on the planet. You know, historically, it's been at the northernmost limit of viable grape growing in France. You know, it's always been famous, you know, for its very cool temperatures and low alcohol levels and, you know, low sugar ripeness and all this. I think that, well, and certainly the data, you know, like for climate change in Champagne is alarming. Just a generation ago, you know, if you speak to people, you know, winemakers, you know, 40 something winemakers, they talk about harvesting in Champagne when they were kids, and it would always be in October. They would always say, you know, we were in school and we had to get out of class to, you know, go like do harvest and all this. Well, when I first started, you know, working with Champagne about 20 years ago, it was normal for a harvest to be in mid-September. So historically, we've had now 4 or 5 vintages that have started in August, which is insane for Champagne. I mean, this is, you know, this would have been unbelievable 50 years ago. But all of these vintages have been in the last 15 years. So 2003, 2007, 2011, and now 2018. In the short term, climate change in Champagne, it isn't a bad thing, right? We get ripeness, we get consistency in vintages. Yeah, I mean, in the short term, you know, it can be it can generate positive results. What we're worried about is what happens in 20 years, or what happens in 50 years, or what happens in 100 years. And, you know, that's something that we don't have the answer to.
While we're thinking about it, because I remember the Côte de Bar does grow more Pinot Noir. Is that still the case? Or are they going to maybe shift to Chardonnay?
I mean, there's already a shift, not even for climate reasons, but just stylistic reasons, or, you know, just... Honestly, there are these experiments that the CIVC does with grape varieties, and because you know there are 7 grape varieties that are authorized for planting today in Champagne, but you know there are these experiments with other varieties to see what would happen, and then also experiments with hybridizing varieties and things like this. I mean, this is all like kind of sci-fi and kind of in the future. I'm not sure that in our lifetimes we're going to see much of a varietal shift in Champagne. I think that we're going to be using the same, same 7 grape varieties, and really the same 3 primary ones. But, you know, I think that certainly in the vineyards, people are talking more about how they take care of the vines, canopy management, and, these things that, people talk about in warmer regions, which the Champenois have never had to deal with. And so now, learning from warmer regions about how to mitigate the effects of a warmer climate, perhaps looking at site selection and maybe the vineyards that were the greatest 50 years ago aren't going to be the greatest vineyards in 50 years time.
Right.
We don't know.
Well, then, would you say this is the golden age of Champagne?
It is certainly one of them. I mean, we've seen several, golden ages of Champagne. You could say that one was at the end of the 19th century. Certainly one was in the 50s, 60s. But in right now, which maybe started like 10 or 15 years ago, this is really exciting. I think that, just looking at the history of Champagne, I would guess that in terms of diversity, in terms of overall quality, median quality, just in terms of the sheer volume of high quality champagnes available for us to drink, this is certainly one of the most exciting times in history to be buying and drinking champagne.
Okay, Peter, our final question that we ask everybody on the Wine Scholar Guild podcast, if you were a wine, which wine would you be and why?
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. I guess I might be something like Cedric Bouchard's La Bolloré. It's a Pinot Blanc champagne from the Aube. It's sort of off the beaten path. It's not to everybody's taste, but it's a really interesting wine, and it has, it always has something to say. And if I can aspire to that, I suppose it's not so bad.
I think that sums it all up. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And listeners, you can find out more information about the Champagne Master Level Program, immersion trips, and so much more on the website, wineschollerguild.org.